Okay, so good morning, everyone. This week we put an end to Sefer Bereshit. We closed the book on the story of Yosef and his brothers, and we really set up what's going to be the next saga as we go from really what is a book about a small family and individual people to what becomes a book of a nation, right? Bereshit is all about this one family with individual people, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. It's what they call Sefer Ha'avot. This is the book of the fathers. And starting out, you know, this small clan, this small family, and next week it's going to multiply. The very beginning of Sefer Shemot is Paru, Vayishritzu, and they grow, and we go from family to a nation. But before we can do that, we really have to close the book on this family and see, you know, this family of Yaakov has gone through a lot of trials and tribulations, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of difficult stories, a lot of deception, a lot of hardships. And how does the book really end? Does the book end, you know, the way we would hope it would end, or are there still some unresolved things? There'll be a couple of interesting ways of looking at this. And we're going to do it through the lens of one very important question, and that is really the question of truth, the question of emet. The concept of truth is a very prominent, a very important concept in Torah. The Torah speaks a tremendous amount about telling the truth, midvar sheker tirhak, distancing ourselves from falsehoods and lying. One of the Ten Commandments is not to be a false witness. And so we know and understand that telling the truth, being honest people, being forthcoming and outright is a very important thing. It's something that the Torah values and is a foundational principle of what it means to live a Jewish life. It goes as far as to make its way into some very interesting halachic concepts. I'll give you one just halacha idea that usually bothers people a little bit, but it's an interesting one how you apply it, because it's something our community does a lot, is the concept of genevat da'at. Genevat da'at is stealing a person's knowledge. What that basically means is doing something to deceive another person or getting them to think one thing when you really mean something else. I'll give you an example of that. The halacha tells us, it's a Gemara in Masechet Hulin, and Rambam brings it down in his Laws of Hilchot Deot, that a person should not invite somebody to his home if he knows that that person is not going to come. In other words, let's say you're having somebody over for Friday night dinner. You invite one family over for Friday night dinner. Now you turn to yourself, you say, you know, I really don't want to invite those other people, right? There's another friend who's like part of the group, but you don't really like them so much. You don't really get along. You're like, I really don't want to invite those people. Someone tells him, you know what? It doesn't matter. Guess what? They're going away for the weekend. You don't know that. Invite them, ki'ilu, you want them to come, and they're going to tell you that we're not coming anyway because they're going away for the weekend. So beautiful, you're able to kill two birds with one stone. You don't make them feel bad. You invite them over, but you know that they're not coming because you really don't want them to have. Halakha tells us you're forbidden to do that. You can't do that. Why? You're giving them a false impression, a false idea. You're pretending to invite them as if you're friendly with them, as if you like them, as if you care about them. Really, in the back of your mind, you don't want them to come. But you know you have a piece of information that you're going to use to manipulate the situation. So a lot of that, you know, our community does this a lot, the whole faddal, right? Faddal, come, yeah, you have a certain amount of invitations, right? So you tell yourself, you know, I'll send this person an invitation, but I know they're not coming anyway, right? I know they're not going to come, right? But okay, they'll think that I don't want them to come, or I know they're, whatever it may be, it's giving a false impression. It's deceiving the person into thinking that you really care about them, that you're really close with them, but really, really you're not. The Gemara gives a few other examples. Another example, once upon a time, they had like barrels of wine. So to open up a barrel of wine was like a big deal. You have to now drink the whole vat of wine, right? So if you opened up a barrel for somebody when they came over to your house, that was like a big deal. That showed, wow, you really care about these people. You're willing to sacrifice and open a whole barrel of wine just for these one people. So the halakha tells us, right, if a person knows that he's going to really sell the rest of that barrel, he can't open it up in front of the people without telling them, by the way, I'm opening this, but I'm planning on selling it tomorrow. Why? Because otherwise he'll give them the wrong impression that it's as if he's opening the barrel just for them because they're these great people and he really loves them so much, when really he would never do it if he wasn't selling it the next day. You get the gist of what's happening here. This is called tricking or deceiving somebody into thinking one thing, and you're kind of playing around with their ideas of what this relationship really is, when it's really not all that. And so that's called genevat da'at. The halakha tells us that's forbidden. This is just one example among many about how much the Torah views the concept of truth and the importance of being forthright and outcoming, that you can't even do things without actually telling a lie, but that could be perceived by other people in one way when they really mean something else. So truth is obviously something very, very important, a cornerstone of what it means to be Jewish. The question is, does anything override the truth? Are there any situations where the truth gets pushed aside for some other kind of consideration?
So in order to protect people's feelings or shalom bayit, maybe.
Okay. Okay.
I think the concept of a white lie.
Okay, so the question is, you want to say it's okay to, if you practice your feelings, even in the case of genevat da'at, by the way, the Gemara says if you're doing it out of respect, out of honor for the person, there could be a kind of situation where that's okay, where that's allowed. If you're protecting someone's feelings, if you don't want to embarrass somebody, okay, that might be. The question is, do we have a source for such a thing? Or is it just something that we logically think of? Uh-huh, okay, very good. What happened there? And then what happened?
And Hashem protected her.
Okay. So we're gonna bring that up in one of the Gemarot that we quote over here. There could be another source in this week's parasha. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say I think it's a Rashi though. It's like Aharon was like the made shalom bayit between people.
Right. There's a Mishnah. I actually studied this with Gabe last night, right? There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that talks about being from the students of Aharon, and they tell a story about how Aharon would try to make peace between two people, and he would go to one person. If two people were in a fight, he'd go to one person and say, you know, I spoke to the other guy, he really feels bad about it, when that really wasn't true. And then the other person would tell the same thing, and this would give them the impression that they would go ahead and make up. So it seems like everybody is sort of on the page of to tell, you know, to fudge the story a little bit, tell a little white lie here or there in order to make peace between people, peace between husband and wife. We have this notion that that should be okay. The question is, do we have a source for it? Are there any sources within the Torah stories that happen? We mentioned one, potentially Abraham and Sarah story. The Gemara will bring that up. But is that something that's acceptable? It's interesting that non-Jewish philosophers, was a philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant, very, very famous German philosopher, wrote a lot of books about philosophy. He said, truth overrides everything. You're never allowed to lie. If someone comes to your home and someone's trying to murder them, this was Kant's idea. He said, if someone's trying to murder your friend, and your friend comes to your home and hides in your home, and the murderer comes and says, is this person here? He said, you have to tell them the truth. You have to say, yes, person's here. You're not allowed to lie, even in the case of saving someone's life. That was Kant's idea, right? He said, why? He said, because if something is morally correct, if truth is morally correct, it's morally correct in all situations. It has to be across the board 100%. There's no kind of situation that you could start to manipulate the truth. And if you start to do it in one situation, now you're going to start to do it in another, and you could justify it. It says it has to be objectively moral. If telling the truth is objectively moral, it applies in all situations. We know that nothing, at least nothing in the Torah really follows that line of thinking. There's very few things in the Torah that are 100% across the board, other than potentially Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, Shfichut Damim, the three things you give up your life for that are just, the three cardinal sins. But it seems that Torah has a very different view. And potentially there's a story that happens in this week's parasha that I think could give us a little bit of information and idea about this very question, about is the truth bendable and in what circumstances is it? After Yaakov dies, he gives his berachot, his last will and testaments to his sons, and he passes away. They bring him to the land of Canaan, they bring him to Eretz Israel according to his wishes. Yosef and the rest of the brothers, along with a tremendous entourage of people from Mitzrayim, and they bury Yaakov in the land of Israel, in Eretz Canaan, and then they come back to Mitzrayim. And the text of the Torah gives us six verses of a very interesting back and forth between Yosef and his brothers post Yaakov Avinu's life. Take a look at source number 1 in verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrong that that we did?" The brothers are nervous that now that their father has gone, Yosef is now going to seek revenge against them. There's a precedent for that, right? What would be the precedent for that? What other story in Bereshit have we seen where someone waits for someone to die to take revenge against their brother? Yaakov and Esav, right? Esav, even Esav, who's not necessarily the highest of moral characters as we've illustrated, even he turns around and says, "I have to wait for my father to die. Yikrevu yemei evil avi. I'll wait for my father to die and then I'll go and kill Yaakov." So there's this notion that people have, at least biblical characters have, that you don't seek retribution against your sibling, against your family, while the patriarch or matriarch are still around. You got to wait for them to go. So the brothers now see, maybe Yosef during this time, this whole 17-year period in Mitzrayim, hasn't been doing anything to us because Yaakov is alive. He doesn't want to take revenge. Now Yaakov is gone. Who knows what he's going to do? So what do the brothers do? So they sent this message to Yosef. Before his death, your father left this instruction. Verse 17, "So shall you say to Yosef, 'Forgive, I urge you, the offense and guilt of your brothers who treated you so harshly. Therefore, please forgive the offense of the servants of the God of your father.'" And Joseph was in tears as they spoke to him. The brothers send a message to Yosef that Yaakov instructed pre his death that Yosef should forgive the brothers for what they did to him, and that he should not seek retribution against his brothers.
Is that true?
You tell me. Right? So the question is, did Yaakov really do this? We don't see any textual evidence anywhere else that Yaakov left such an instruction. It's not written anywhere that Yaakov wanted Yosef to know that he should forgive the brothers after he died. It's not mentioned anywhere. Now, the fact that it's not mentioned doesn't necessarily remove the possibility that he did. Many times things are not necessarily mentioned in the text of the Torah. It could very well be that the Torah is recording the brothers' statements in Yaakov's mouth, and that's the Torah expects you to understand that they're not lying. They're really saying what Yaakov meant to say, just the Torah doesn't record it twice, it records it once. That is a potential, that is a possibility. But maybe we can look in a moment a little bit deeper at what happens here to see, are the brothers really telling the truth? Did Yaakov actually leave an instruction of such words? Look at verse 18. The brothers don't stop at the messengers. His brothers went to him themselves. They go personally, flung themselves before him and said, "We are prepared to be your slaves." But Yosef said to them, "Have no fear. Am I a substitute for God? Hatahat Elohim ani? Can I take the place of God? No. Besides, although you intended me harm, God intended it for good, so as to bring about the present result, the survival of many people." So we have a back and forth conversation. The brothers are nervous that Yosef will take revenge on them. They send at least some kind of instruction from Yaakov that Yosef should forgive them. Yosef cries as a result of hearing this. The brothers are not sure what that means, that he cried. They don't leave it to chance just with messengers. They go themselves and they prostrate themselves in front of Yosef and say, "Please forgive us, we'll be your slaves." And Yosef says, "Absolutely not. I'm not in place of God. It's not my position to take any kind of revenge against you or to punish you for any of your deeds. That's God's decision. God takes that into account. Not to mention the fact that everything worked out for the best. Why should I take revenge on you with what you did? Everything worked out the way it was supposed to. I'm able to provide for you, and we're going to live happily ever after." This is the back and forth of the brothers after the Yaakov's died. So we have a couple of things that stand out. One is the question of, are the brothers really telling the truth over here? Is what they're saying really something that happened or not? Aside from that, what else kind of stands out to you in these six pisukim about Yosef and his brothers? Anything that strikes a chord? Okay, so Yosef cries originally. That's his first reaction, which seems to prompt the brothers to then not only leave it to chance with messengers, to actually go in front of them. So it's possible that they misunderstood why he was crying, right? It seems like Yosef is crying because he feels bad that the brothers would suspect him of wanting to take revenge, right? Someone suspects you of wanting to do something that you never thought you were going to do. You feel terrible, like, well, you really thought that I would be such a person to take revenge on you? So that's why we know Yosef is crying. Potentially the brothers think Yosef is crying because they brought up all of his past terrible things that they did, and he's crying, and maybe he's going to actually act on that feeling, those feelings of emotion against the brothers, and take revenge. So the brothers say, okay, we'll be your slaves, you know, please. They misinterpret Yosef's crying to a certain extent. Right? But that seems to be what's happening here between verses 17, 18, and 19. Right? Until Yosef finally addresses the issue, he tells them, don't fear, I'm not going to take revenge on you. Everything happened for the best. One thing that stands out to me is that it's still clear, at least from what I'm reading, that the relationship between the brothers and Yosef is not 100% repaired. Over the 17-year period, if they are still thinking that Yosef would take revenge on them even after Yaakov's death, it shows that there's still a lot of tension between the brothers and Yosef. Everything is not fully back to the way it once was. That they would think that he would actually seek revenge against them. And potentially it never does. There is what to read in this story, that it never gets back to 100%. Which makes sense. Makes sense. You sell your brother down to Egypt, you may never get 100% forgiveness back for that. It's funny, the brothers never ask for forgiveness themselves. They do this little ruse over here by saying, Yaakov said to forgive us. They never personally, at least not from the text, they never personally come to Yosef and say, Yosef, please forgive us. They never deal with it, you know, head on. And we never see Yosef really say, I forgive you for what you did. He says, I'm not in place of God, so I can't punish you. It's okay, everything happens for the best. But, you know, it's like that Seinfeld where he says, I got to get the apology, I got to get the forgiveness. He never actually gets the forgiveness, and he never really says to them, don't worry, I forgive you. He never uses those words. He says it happens for the best. He never says that he forgives them. There are some commentaries, that Rabbeinu Bahya is one of those commentaries, who says the relationship was never fully mended. We end off Sefer Bereshit on a nice note that Yosef is not going to take revenge against them, which is a great thing. It's an unbelievable feat for somebody not to take revenge on his brothers after all the terrible things that they did to him. But it's not fully repaired. It can never get 100% to where it should have been. He actually mentions, it's because of that, that he says the death of the 10 martyrs, notice the 10 martyrs, the 10 people who died al Kiddush Hashem, he says was an atonement for the fact that the 10 brothers sold Yosef into slavery and never fully got forgiveness for that. That was what the atonement was. That's a little bit of a deeper kind of idea. I don't necessarily know how to explain that personally, but he uses that to prove that the relationship is not fully mended here. Let's just come back to the question of, did they lie? Did the brothers lie? Was it true what they said? You could make an argument that they're relating something that actually happened, but if you look at the Pesukim very carefully, it would seem to indicate otherwise. Because if you look at Pasuk 15, the very first Pasuk that we read, it says that the brothers, where did they give this charge of Yaakov? They passed over Yaakov's words. The Pasuk starts, when the brothers saw that their father died, and they said, oh, Yosef is going to hate us, and he's going to return us all of the bad that we did to him. That motivates them to send a message to Yosef that their father said you're supposed to forgive us. If this was really true, what? Right. If it was really true that Yaakov left those instructions, then it shouldn't make a difference what the brothers think. Maybe he'll give us retribution. Maybe he won't take revenge on us. They saw that he died. None of that should make a difference. It should have just said, the brothers came to Yosef after he died and said, by the way, your dad told us to tell you this, right? But the fact that you see their emotions pre them telling what Yaakov said gives you a suspicion that what they said over here was not really true, that they kind of made it up because of their fear that Yosef would take revenge against them. Not to mention the question of, if Yaakov really did leave these instructions, why didn't he just tell Yosef when he was alive? Like, why didn't he just come to Yosef and say, Yosef, before I die, I just want to let you know, don't take revenge against your brothers. Why not tell that to him directly? Why leave it for the brothers to send the message after he died? What would be the point of that? And so because of those two questions, it's very likely, most of the commentaries over here say that the brothers made this up. They created a lie over here to try and keep the relationship in the family somewhat at peace. And that's where he turned to source number two, which is a Gemara in Masechet Yebamot, which gives us this idea, the one that we started with, about when can you bend the truth. I'll read the English over here. It says, Rabbi Elai said in the name of Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon, it is permitted for a person to depart from the truth in a matter that will bring peace. If it's meant for peace, for shalom, between people in their relationship, you can bend the truth a little bit. Tell the white lie. How do we know? He brings proof from our parasha. As it is stated, as it says in the Pasuk, your father commanded us before he died, saying, so you shall say to Yosef, please pardon your brother's crime, etc. So the Gemara is clearly taking that as a falsehood, as something that never actually happened. Rabbi Natan says, Rabbi Natan goes a step further, he says, it is a mitzvah. It's not just something that you're permitted to do, it's something that you're obligated to do. It's a mitzvah to lie, if it means that you're going to create peace between people. And you have to be certain that that's going to be the case. He says it's a mitzvah. As it is stated, and Shmuel said, how can I go and Saul will hear, Shaul will hear and kill me. There it's talking about where Shmuel had already anointed David to be the next king after Shaul. And God instructs Shmuel to go to a certain place. And he's nervous that Shaul will kill Shmuel if he finds out about David, that he's coming to that place to anoint David. Shaul's going to ask him, what are you doing here, Shmuel? If Shmuel answers, I'm here to anoint David as the new king instead of you, Shaul's going to go nuts. He'd potentially kill Shmuel. So he needs a lie to figure out what he could say to Shaul if Shaul asks him what he's doing here. And God, in fact, in the next Pasuk, provides him a lie. God tells him, if Shaul asks you, this is what you should say. God instructs him to lie. Right, so he says, clearly it's not only something that is permitted, it's something that God is instructing you to do. It's a command, mitzvah, to do it. And then they go a step further. It was taught, this is what Jenny brought up, it was taught in the school of Rabbi Ishmael, great is peace. Peace is so important. As even the Holy One, blessed be He, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, departed from the truth for it. Even God lied to create peace. As initially it is written that Sarah said of Abraham, and my Lord is old. She said when she found out that she was going to have a child, she left and she said, well, I'm not in the way of women to be able to give birth, right? I'm not in that stage of my life. And not to mention, Va'adoni Zaken, my master, Abraham, my husband, is old. When God repeated these words to Abraham, right? And in the end, it is written that God told Abraham that Sarah said, and I am old. Only that she was old. He didn't repeat the statement that she said about Abraham Avinu being old. So all of these sources in this Gemara are indicating to us that it's A, permitted to lie. Some cases it's a mitzvah to lie. If a person knows it's going to create peace, and even God operates himself under these premises, where he will actually manipulate the truth in certain unique cases to create peace or to maintain peace between two individuals. Any questions on that? Now this is something that makes us a little bit uneasy, because the question then is, how do I know? How do I know if I could lie? What's the line exactly, right? Where do you draw it? Because if you start getting into the habit of, oh, I'm going to lie because that's going to make peace, that's going to make peace, that's going to make peace. My wife asks me where I am, I lie because I don't want to tell her where I really am because she's going to be upset at me, right? It's a slippery slope to the point where now you're just outright lying instead of just telling the truth because you just want to save your back. That's not necessarily to create peace. We're talking about creating an outside person, perhaps, changing certain things to maintain peace between other people. A person really has to see what is the example that he can do that. Because if a person gets into the habit of lying and not telling the truth to save himself because he thinks it's always going to create peace, you just become someone who's not truthful. Somebody, a lot of times, telling the truth is what also maintains peace. I'm glad you told me the truth. I'm upset, but you told me the truth. To lie can sometimes get a person into a sticky situation. So that becomes a little bit difficult. What is the line and how do we draw it? It's not always so clear. It's really not always so clear. And a lot of times you have to ask personal questions in the particular situation that a person is in. I'd say sometimes when in doubt, err on the side of caution and keep to the truth, because it seems like truth is a cornerstone of what we want. I'll mention one other thing about this Gemara. The Gemara brings us two stories, really three, but I'll mention two. One is the story that we have in our parasha, and the other one is the story about Avraham and Sarah. Why do we need both stories to teach us that you're allowed to manipulate the truth to maintain peace? Why wasn't one story enough? Why did you need both of them? Because each story teaches us something that the other story doesn't. If we only had the story of Yosef and his brothers, so you'd think, well, maybe Yosef and his brothers didn't do the right thing. How do I know that that's really the right thing to do? They're human beings. Maybe they made a mistake. Maybe God would not be happy with that. So that's why you need the story of God to tell you, well, if God's doing it, then it's something that's acceptable that you can be able to do. So we need the story of God, for sure. Question is, why isn't the story of God with Abraham and Sarah enough? What about the story of Yosef? Why do we need the story of Yosef and his brothers? Because if you notice in the story of Abraham and Sarah, God omits something. He doesn't change the facts. He just leaves out the whole story, the whole truth. Sarah said two things. She said, I'm old. I'm not at the stage where I can have a child. And my husband's old. God comes to Abraham and says, Sarah left because she said she was old. He leaves out, conveniently, the part about Abraham being old. So if you only had the story of God, you could say, maybe just not telling the whole truth, omitting a piece of the story, that's when you're allowed to change it, just not telling everything. But to actually come up with a lie, to really tell something which is 100% false, maybe that's not allowed even for peace. That's where the story of Yosef comes in. The whole thing that they told about Yaakov was a complete fabrication of the truth. It had no validity whatsoever. And even they are allowed to do it because they want to be able to maintain peace. So each story kind of gives us something that the other story does not necessarily have. Huh? The story of Shmuel, that's where the Gemara tells us that it was a mitzvah, because God instructed somebody else to do something like that. So one is God doing it, one is Yosef doing it. The middle story is God instructed Shmuel to do it this way. So that's another addition, that it could be potentially a mitzvah. So just to sum up what we've done so far, everything seems to indicate that we know truth is a value, a cornerstone of Judaism, but it can be bended at certain points to create peace. We saw it from the story of Yosef, we see it from a couple of other biblical stories. And I want to close with one last point, and then sort of tie it up together. It comes from source number 3 on the opposite side, a very interesting Midrash Rabbah about the creation of humanity. And we're meant to understand this Midrash in a more figurative sense, but it really tells us about God's view of human beings. Rabbi Shimon said, when the Holy One, blessed be He, came to create Adam, the ministering angels formed themselves into groups and parties. So they started, the malachim started to come around to discuss whether or not man should be created, right? This could be a little bit where the Torah says that God consulted with the angels about the creation of man. He said, Na'aseh Adam, let us create. Obviously, God is the only creator in the end of the day. He doesn't really need to seek consult from anybody else. But this is an interesting way of the rabbis formulating some of the ideas that went into creating the human being. So some of them came to God saying, let him be created. Yes, create man. Great idea, God. Whilst others urged, let him not be created. Some of the malachim opposed the creation of human beings. Thus it is written, this is what the Pasuk hints to in Tehillim, David HaMelech says, love and truth fought together, right? Love and truth fought against each other. Righteousness and peace combated each other. The Pasuk is, Hesed ve'emet nifgashu, kindness and, right, love and truth, kindness and truth fought against each other. Tzedek ve'shalom, righteousness and peace, nashaku, they also combated once against the other. Each of these things are opposites of each other in a certain extent. Chesed and emet are really opposites of each other to a certain degree. Kindness and truth. How are kindness and truth different from each other? How are they opposite?
Harsh.
Huh?
Truth is sometimes harsh.
In what way?
It makes you face, you know, certain facts.
Right.
Maybe you don't want to face.
Right. Right. You do something wrong. The emet is, if you do something wrong, the truth is consequence. That's it. There shouldn't be any debate about it, right? Where does chesed come in? God comes in and says, okay, like teshubah, for example. The whole concept of teshubah is built on this. If we do something wrong, that's it. There should be a consequence. There's no debate. There's no discussion about it, right? You don't go into a court of law and start pleading with the judge and say, but please, I really feel bad. I really regret it. I know I killed that person, but I didn't mean to. You can't do that. That's it. You did it. You get the consequence. There's no getting out of it. You can't go on the mercy. But chesed comes along and chesed sort of counteracts truth and says, no, there's an element of kindness, there's an element of mercy that can balance it. Same for tzedek v'shalom, righteousness and peace. Those are things that are sometimes opposites of each other, in our case, right? What's righteous, what's maybe moral, is to tell the truth. But that doesn't always fit so well with keeping peace between each other. So there's these two, there's all of these things that the world needs, love, kindness, truth, righteousness, peace that are conflicting with each other. And each of them are saying, make man, don't make man. Love said, let him be created, right? Chesed said, let create man. Why? Because he will dispense acts of love. He'll do kindness, he'll do good things, right? Man does charity, takes care of other people. Create man. Truth said, but Emet came along and said, let him not be created. No, don't create man, because he is compounded of falsehood. Man lies, they cheat, they steal, they're not truthful people, right? So don't create them. Righteousness said, let him be created, right? Tzedek actually came along and said, yes, let man be created, because he will perform righteous deeds. He's going to do good things. He's going to make the world a better place. Peace said, Shalom said, let him not be created. Why? Because he is full of strife. Man fights, war, combativeness. Very hard for human beings to make peace one with the other. So why get into it? So now you got two against two. It's an even fight. Two qualities saying that man can't possess this, don't create them. Two qualities that man does possess saying create him. What did the Lord do? What did Hashem do? He had to tip the scales in one way. He took truth, he took emet, and cast it to the ground. Threw him away. In other words, he made it two against one, right? God eliminated one of the angels from it. Which angel did he eliminate? He eliminated truth from it. Said the ministering angels, the other angels were like baffled before the Holy One, blessed be He. Ribono Shel Olam, sovereign of the universe, why do you despise your seal? You love truth. God is emet, right? They say Hotamo is emet. The seal of God is truth. God is all about truth, right? Why'd you throw truth down to the ground? Take him out of the equation. Why do you despise your seal? Let truth arise from the earth. Let truth come up from the ground, said God. Hence it is written, let truth spring up from the earth. Emet me'eretz tzmach. What's going on over here at the very end? What is the Midrash trying to tell us? That ultimately, as important as truth is to God, it's the seal of God, it's the cornerstone of the world, there are other values that are more important than it, believe it or not. One of those values is peace, is shalom. Shalom as a concept overrides, it's a value, it's a higher priority on God's list even than emet. Emet will come up from the ground. It's there, you still need truth, can't live without truth. It'll come up from the ground. Man will have to embed truth into his life. But ultimately, peace is the most important thing. Peace trumps everything. Making shalom between people, there can't be anything more important, even if it means, like we said, bending the truth a little bit here or there. And I'll add to it, because if you read like psychologists, like there's a question, a book I'm reading about Lashon Hara, right? There's a question, am I allowed to tell Lashon Hara if it's true? It's true. It's a fact, right? Someone came to us, said, how was the summer rental that you took this last summer? Right? How was it? Okay. How am I going to respond to that? This was good. This wasn't so good. Am I allowed to say it was true? Right? It was very hot upstairs. Whatever it is. I'm talking figurative, like not reality. But someone asks you, how was that place you rented? How was that vacation that you went on? Now you want to respond. You want to give facts. Right? Are you allowed to say some of those facts? Are you not allowed to say some of those facts? So that's beyond a little bit what we're doing here in terms of the class, right? But there's a concept of here, you have to tell the truth, right? But maybe that's going to cause strife. And sometimes, in some cases, to reveal information, even if it's factual, is forbidden. It's still considered Lashon Hara. But how could that be? It's true. Sometimes what we think is true, your perception of the truth, there isn't always a clear truth, right? There isn't always a clear truth. What's true to me, or what I see, sometimes your memory plays tricks on you, your mind plays tricks on you, you see something and you automatically internalize it as your opinion, and you say, oh, that's the fact. But it's not always 100% the fact, right? So truth can sometimes be a tricky thing. Do we ever really have a 100% truth? You could debate that. And so that's where maybe the concept comes in, that peace will override truth, because is there always 100% truth? Okay.
So, subjective truth is opinion. Actually.
Right. Right. So, but we'll see something.
Truth.
Right. There definitely is objective truth. Like 2 + 2 = 4. Right.
If your wife says you had your like dinner and you say it was inedible.
Right.
That's opinion,
a subject. Right. Right.
So you could really say right. Something nicer, and it's not fact. But if somebody says, "Well, what color is this?"
Right. Right. But most of the time in our dialogues, we say, like, someone asks you, you know, what happened at the restaurant the other night, right? What happened? They tell us the story. Oh, well, this person got into a fight. I'm telling the truth, right? But you don't necessarily know if that could be just your perception of how the events occurred. You may not even know 100% how the events occurred. Maybe that's how you saw it and your mind already interpreted it. So you're right, it's an opinion truth, but even sometimes when we relate stories that we've seen with our own eyes, we could even relate them distorted.
Video then?
Huh?
The video is fact, so is that like...
But even that could be interpreted by somebody very differently, right? I'm showing you a fact, but how you interpret it, you could perceive the character one way, you could perceive the character the other way. That's the point of why it's not, it could be Lashon Hara, because I'm telling you everything that happened, but how is that person going to interpret what happened? If they interpret it, I could be telling you the facts of the story in one way that paint the person positively, you interpret it negatively. Right? That's why the Torah goes against, tells us not to peddle information, to peddle gossip. Even to tell over a story that you saw happen, just to tell it over exactly how it happened without thinking that you're giving any kind of commentary on it, even that becomes asur. It's called rechilut. The rabbis don't allow that. The Torah doesn't allow that. Lo telech rechil ba'amecha. Because you don't know how that person's going to interpret the story, what kind of perception they create. You don't know the context of that person. Maybe from that one person, he now develops a whole persona of what that person does, just from that one story that was never meant to be happening. The point that I'm trying to illustrate, and then I'll come to you in a minute, is that can there ever be, when you're talking about people, when you're talking about events, can there ever be 100% truth from the perspective of human beings? It's debatable. It's debatable. You could make a good argument that no. Sometimes you could say yes, sometimes you could say no. But I think that cloudiness around truth is what leads God to say that's why peace overrides it. Because ultimately, if you could create peace, that's an objective good. That's an objective good that could exist all across the board. That's something that automatically brings good to the world. And that's why in his mind, I think in what the Midrash is trying to illustrate, it was worthy to push Emet down in order to create human beings, that peace should rise up above all else. So I think that's for me, the takeaway from this story. Bereshit ends on this with this kind of idea, I think, to teach us a little bit of the reconciliation, a little bit of the peace that is made, maybe not fully, but I think it shows us what God views. He ends the book on a book that has been very not peaceful, right? A lot of strife between people ends on at least something of a peaceful note. And I think that we could take that comfort with us as we move in to Sefer Shemot. Hey, Jenny.
No, I mean, I guess you kind of said what I was going to say when you ended, but I think because what it's trying to teach us is, regardless if something is true or not, you have a video, it's the truth. It doesn't matter, it's not promoting peace. It's not promoting peace. So like, what would be your point in showing
right.
the video? Or what would be the point in speaking about somebody? Like, the important part
right.
is to promote peace,
right.
to keep people, you know, feeling good enough about each other.
100%.
It's really regardless if it's true or not.
Right. I agree with you. I think in most situations that would be the case. Where it gets a little bit hairy, and we'll just pose a couple of questions, is someone asks you, you know, my son is dating this girl. Do you think it's a good? Do you think it's a good match? Can you tell me anything about the family?
So they say that if it's for the purpose of something like that,
right?
Then of course, one-on-one between the two of you.
Right. So intentions do play a very important role, right? About what it is that you're telling over and why you're saying it and what's your goal, what's your objective. We have this issue, let's say, as teachers, right? When you need to relay information about a student to a principal, the student did this, the student did that. You know, we have a very difficult situation now. I have to convey information that's necessary. So we always tell ourselves we have to convey that information not from a perspective of I'm upset at the student or I just want to tell people what's going on. I need to relay that information to the people in power to help the student. If it's done, being done for the benefit of the other person, so then it takes it out of the realm, at least for that, what we consider Lashon Hara. Sometimes, though, unfortunately, and I've been part of this, you have teachers that are just gossiping about students. Can you believe what happened in my class? They're just like unloading their in-class baggage around other teachers when other teachers can't do it. Right? If I go to another teacher and say, do you have this student? I'm having a struggle with them. Can you tell me if you work? That's positive. Sometimes people unload about students that other teachers don't even have. They're just getting things off their chest. That's a problem. That's Lashon Hara. I've been around that. It does happen, unfortunately. But the idea is if you maintain the professionalism and you always care about the person, so then that's relating information that might be necessary. But again, even then, when you're relating that information, is it 100% the truth? It's the truth as you see it. It's a more subjective truth than it is an objective truth. And so maybe in that case, sometimes it's like, I'm not going to give them all the information because I don't want to create tension, you know, at what point they are in the relationship or anything like that. These are very difficult questions. They're not always very clear cut. They're always important to ask people who are in the know about what to do in these kinds of scenarios. But at least this situation illustrates that there is a push and pull between truth and peace that exists. And so things are not black and white as Kant once said them. They're a little bit more gray, and we have to try to navigate the gray areas as best we can.
So if I could just give you what I was, I took from this, you told me the love and the truth and the righteousness and peace, and I think it's a little bit different, you know, different direction, but in relationships, as a parent or as a wife, sometimes we get stuck on truth and righteousness, and we get stuck on, let's say, disciplining our children because of X, Y, Z. This is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way it's supposed to. And when you read that, the first thing I saw was that love and peace trumps all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe, you know, even when we're doing it for the right reasons, you know, putting love and peace above the truth and the righteousness could benefit us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it goes back to intentions. When you're disciplining a child as a teacher, as a parent, where are you coming from? Are you coming from just a frustrated sense of they're disrespecting me, or they're not doing this, or they're not doing that? Or are you coming from a place of love? I want to help my child. I want them to become better. Those look and feel very, very different. When a person comes from a place of anger and frustration and negativity, their discipline of their child is going to be very different than if they're coming from, I want what's best for my kid, I want to love my child, I want him to do better the next time. The words we choose will be different, the tone of voice that we speak in will be different, the kinds of consequences that we give will be much more clearly thought out, much more midah keneged midah. Usually when we discipline from a point of frustration, you know, we lose ourselves, we give ridiculous consequences that don't make any sense, right? Whereas if we pause and think, what consequence can I give in this situation that will get my child to better understand what he did wrong and how to not do it in the future, and we think that thought through, our discipline can change 100%, completely the opposite. And believe it or not, children who are very perceptive notice that. They will know if my parent is disciplining me from a positive place or from a negative place. It doesn't mean that you can't discipline. It doesn't mean that you don't have a truth and righteousness aspect because you want your kids to follow that path. But it comes from a very different place when you put love and peace at the top of it and you draw everything from that. It's a completely different ballgame. And children notice that. Students notice that. We notice that from a government official, whatever it may be. There's a very, very big difference of where it comes from and what the source of it is. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Have a great day, everyone.